Thank you, Drew, for those songs. I think the song Thank You is so fitting tonight. So just to be able to say thank you to God for all of the good that He does for us. I love the calm assuredness and confidence that the writer of Psalms has there in chapter 16 in verse 1 when he talks about, when he says, to preserve me, God, because I take my refuge in you. And towards the end of it, the confidence that he has to say that the Lord is my portion. I chose to serve the Lord. And that's not always something that's very easy to say in our life, especially in David's life. I don't know that that was always something that was very easy for him to say with a whole lot of confidence. Life teaches us so many things, doesn't it? As we go throughout it, from when we were little kids, we learn that when the oven is on or when the stove is turned on, that is hot. And you do not want to touch it when it is hot. And you learn that, whether it is by trial and error, or if you actually choose to listen to your mother, and you don't touch the burner while it's on, or you don't touch the pan of cookies as soon as it comes out of the oven. We learn about electricity, that you do not put your finger or metal objects into electrical outlets, because that will shock you, and it hurts very badly. Some of us have a little bit harder time learning our lessons than others, don't we? We learn in our lives how to find love. We learn examples of love from our parents as they model that for us, from our grandparents and from the people that we're around. We learn how to find those things. We learn in our lives how to hurt, whether it be in physical pain from the injuries that we suffer as we're learning things, or as it be an emotional type of pain where we have to learn how to deal with some of the problems in life. We learn how to hurt. We also learn how to rejoice, how to be happy when good things are going on in our lives. We love to have that smile on our face, don't we? I don't know about you, but I sure do. To be able to have a smile on my face and know that everything is going just fine and that I love my life, I love where I am. We learn how to rejoice. We learn how to find our friends, don't we? We learn as we meet people, as we interact with people, the types of people that we like. And when you start meeting kids as you go to school, you say, oh, I like that guy, I can hang out with him. Or, I don't know about that guy, I don't think I can spend a whole lot of time with him. And we learn the type of people that we like to surround ourselves with, the people who build us up, who make us feel good, the types of people that we can cry on their shoulder, who will be there to prop us up. All of these things life teaches us, and we could go into the nature versus nurture type of debate, but I don't want to go there tonight. But our life and our life experiences, it helps shape us, and it helps make us who we are. It makes up our personalities. The longer that I've lived, all of 25 and a half years now, the more times I found myself starting to question God. When things are going a little bit different than I think they should, I start wondering, you know, where is God? Why wasn't He there to help me in that situation? Or why didn't He fix this problem? Why did He let this happen to me? Is this really the right choice for me in my life? Is this where He wants me to be? I think it's pretty safe to say that we've probably all been there in our lives, wondering if God is really there, if He's really helping us. And also, the longer that I've lived, the more time I've discovered that I have to look back over all of my life experiences and to see God and to see that He really was there, that He helped in that decision, that it was His guidance that helped that particular situation work out the way it did to help bring me to where I am today. It's comforting to me, and I've told you guys, to be able to look back in my life and say, God was there. It was God who helped with that. It was God who got me through that. To see the moments that He carried me through, even when I was doubting in Him. All of the times in my life when I've questioned Him, I can see that He was there. And as we look back through all of history, we can see that God was there. He was molding and shaping people. He was helping them come to certain crossroads in their lives where they had to make either a decision for Him or a decision against Him. We can see God at work. especially in the Bible. You know, that's the best place to go and to see the story of God as it unfolds before our eyes. And I wonder sometimes if there were ever times in a Bible character's life when they wondered, where is God? Why is this happening to me? Where in the world is God? And there is no one that I wonder about that more than Joseph. You know the guy. In all of his story, all of the story that we know, it's been in our Bible classes since we were little kids. Was there ever a time in his life where Joseph stopped and said, God, what are you doing, man? You know, I want to believe in you, but you keep messing with me, and I don't know if I can keep going on. You know, his family life must have been one of nearly complete mistrust, didn't it? You know, you talked just a couple of Sundays ago about the dysfunction in Joseph's family. He had a cheating father who was cheated by his father-in-law. He had children from at least four different women. He had a brother that slept with his stepmom, and that's just starting down through the list. You almost wonder, how did Joseph make it? You almost start to feel sorry for Joseph for having to come from that sort of a family life. You know, part of me wants to look at this, as a Christian, part of me wants to look at this and say, well, what in the world? How could anybody have a life like that and still be pleasing to God? How could anybody, you know, have their family life like that? I mean, skeletons in the closet, that's not something that we like to talk about in church, is it? All of the demons of the past, all of the things that haunt us. But on a completely different level, I'm very relieved when I see this. I'm very relieved when I see what God can do with such a mess. That if God can use a character who is a cheater to be the father of a nation and to bless the world through Jesus Christ, that's hope for all of us, isn't it? I mean, it really is. If God can do all of that with Jacob and his family, what can he do with you and I in the things that go on in our lives? If we turn to Genesis chapter 37, and that's where we're going to be most of the time tonight. If we turn there, in verse 3 we read this, that Jacob loved Joseph more than all his other sons because he had been born to him when he was old. He made a long robe with full sleeves for him. Very early in the story of Joseph, we find out that he was the favorite son. Don't you just love that idea? Did you grow up in a household like that, some of you? Where you knew that there was a favorite in the house, and it seemed like it was always the younger sibling. I know that I felt that a lot with my sister. I mean, she could get away with murder, and it was okay. Yeah, but if I did one thing wrong, I was grounded for a week. I couldn't watch TV. I couldn't talk on the phone. You know, I never could quite understand all of that. They can get away with anything sometimes. He was the favorite son. In verse 3, he was given a full coat. You know, the coat of many colors, the technicolor dream coat, whatever you want to call it. This was a robe with full sleeves, probably stretched down towards the ground. This was not a shirt that you would have worn to work. Because long sleeves get in the way, long sleeves get dirty. And you don't want those sleeves to get dirty. You don't want the favorite child out there getting dirty all of the time, do you? Because the typical work shirt was a lot shorter and didn't even have sleeves. It was probably stained with sweat and blood, but not Joseph's coat. Not Joseph's coat. Joseph most likely didn't have chores as he was growing up. Joseph dreamed dreams, which in and of itself, that's fine to have dreams. I had dreams just last night. I don't remember any of them. And we all have those dreams, right? But Joseph's problem was he couldn't keep those dreams to himself, could he? He said, listen to the dream that I had. We were all in the field tying up sheaves of wheat when my sheaf got up and stood up straight. Yours formed a circle around mine and bowed down to it. His brothers said, do you think that you're going to be a king and rule over us? So they hated him even more because of his dreams and because of what he said about them. This was just one instance of a dream. Another dream, he told his brothers about. He said, I had another dream in which I saw the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowing down to me. If you were his brothers, what kind of feelings would you be having right about this time in your life? Those of you who had the younger siblings can probably sympathize a little bit with it. But this is pretty extreme. As they see the favoritism displayed, as they see the work that he doesn't have to do, as they see the fact that he was kind of a tattletale. I don't know if we really catch up with that sometimes. But he went out and watched them one day, and he came back and he gave a bad report to his dad. He told on him. As I read through this, you know, it almost sounds as if Joseph took the role of the bratty younger sibling who knew that he was the favorite, doesn't it? That he rubbed it in. Sometimes he would rub it in their faces as he's telling them these dreams. You can almost hear that little thing in his voice that says, you know, I know that I'm better than you. I know that Dad likes me more than you. And Dad certainly didn't help the situation any either with his gift of the coat. And from where I sit and read this story, it's almost hard for me not to say Joseph deserved it, man. That he deserved everything that was about to happen to him, everything that he was about to get. And maybe he did, but that's probably the older sibling in me speaking there. You can imagine a household with a weak father who did nothing to calm down this situation and everything that's going on. You know, and his brothers, it says that when his brothers saw that their father loved Joseph more than he loved them, they hated their brother so much that they would not even speak to him in a friendly manner. They couldn't even come to the breakfast table and say, good morning, Joseph, without grinding their teeth together, without something mean and nasty coming out. They couldn't speak to him in a friendly manner, and it just got worse. That one time when Joseph had a dream and when he told his brothers about it, they hated him even more. I can't imagine what it would be like to live in such a dysfunctional family where your brothers hated you more with every single passing day. And his father, being the passive guy that he is, either doesn't realize the reality of the situation that's going on, or he chooses to ignore it. My guess is that he's probably choosing to ignore it, because that seems to be what Jacob has done through his entire life as a father. He ignores the situation. One day he sends his sons out into the field, as we continue through our story here. It says that one day Joseph's brothers had gone to Shechem to take care of their father's flock. Jacob said to Joseph, I want you to go to Shechem where your brothers are taking care of the flock. And Joseph answered, I am ready. He gets worried about his sons, and rightly so, because they're in Shechem. Do you remember what happened there? This is where one of their sisters was raped, and their reaction to all of this was they killed the men of the village, and then they pillaged, and they took everything. You would be worried about your children if they were going back to this place. And so Jacob, in all of his wisdom, sends Joseph to check on him. The favorite son, the one that he loved the most, the one who told on the older brothers earlier, the one who had dreams. It doesn't really seem to me that Jacob sets Joseph up for success here. It seems like he's kind of setting him up for some failure. You can imagine how his brothers felt. The hatred that was inside of them. I don't know that these verses that we've been reading through really encompass how severe that was towards Joseph. But we see as he searches, he finally finds where his brothers are. As he arrives on the scene, we see an explosion of pent-up emotions in verses 17 through 20. It says that they saw him in the distance, and before they reached them, they plotted against him and decided to kill him. It's amazing sometimes how far hatred can see out onto the horizon, isn't it? You can see him coming, and you've already got the plot ready to go before he gets there. They said to one another, here comes that dreamer. Come on now, let's kill him and throw his body into one of the dry wells. We can say that a wild animal killed him. Then we will see what becomes of his dreams. It's very vengeful, isn't it? We're going to kill him. I love that first reaction, the dreamer. Here he comes. This is the perfect chance. Let's just kill him now and get it over with and see what happens to those dreams. And oddly enough, older and wiser minds step in the form of his brother Reuben, which I think is very odd because if you remember, Reuben was the one who slept with his father's wife. It's hard to imagine wisdom coming from such a guy, but maybe he's trying to make up for it in 21 and 22 that Reuben heard them and tried to save Joseph. He said, let's not kill him. Just throw him into this well in the wilderness, but don't hurt him. He said this planning to save him from them and send him back to his father. The wisdom in all of this, it's pretty good. It's pretty solid. And the other brothers must have agreed because of what happened next in verse 23, that when Joseph came up to his brothers, they ripped off his long robe with full sleeves. Then they took him and threw him into the well, which was dry. While they were eating, they suddenly saw a group of Ishmaelites traveling from Gilead to Egypt. We've been trying to imagine some of that hostility that's pent up inside of them, and now we're kind of seeing it come full circle. You notice the first thing that they did? They didn't kill him, but what did they do? It says that they ripped the robe off of him. They tore it off of his body. They hated that robe because of the symbol that it was of favoritism. It was almost as if to say, you know what, Joseph, you are no better than we are, and we want you to know that. They take his robe, they throw him into the well. And I love the start of verse 25. Did you notice it? It says that while they were eating, after the assault that they had just thrown upon their brother Joseph, they sat down to eat lunch. All of that anger made them hungry. It's amazing to me that there are no guilty consciences here. There are no feelings of remorse, no feelings of regret, no nothing. They turn around and they sit down to eat their lunch, perfectly content with what they just did. I mean, at least they didn't kill him, right? And it kind of sends chills down your spines when you read what they did to their brother in verses 26 through 28. That Judah said to his brothers, what will we gain by killing our brother and covering up the murder? Let's sell him to these Ishmaelites. Then we won't have to hurt him. After all, he is our brother and our own flesh and blood. His brothers agreed, and when some of the Midianite traders came by, the brothers pulled Joseph out of the well and sold him for 20 pieces of silver to the Ishmaelites who took him to Egypt. Does that send a little bit of a chill down your spine? And say, okay, well, we're not going to kill him because, well, he kind of is our brother. We don't want to have that blood on our hands, so we'll sell him. We'll get a little bit of money after him. It's almost like a light bulb goes off with Judah, isn't it? It's like, oh, let's not kill him. And do you notice the price? 20 pieces of silver. 20 pieces of silver. That was a piddly amount of money. That was like the change out of your pocket. You pull it out and you're like, I got a couple of quarters and a dime. Is that okay? 20 pieces of silver was the price that in those days they paid for a handicapped slave. One who either had a physical or mental type disability. And this is the price that they got for their brother. Not even an able-bodied slave. It shows what little respect they had towards him. It shows us a little bit more of their feelings towards him and the fact that they didn't even get a fair price for him. They just said, give us the change out of your pocket and that'll be fine. And we know the rest of the story here in chapter 37, don't we? They take his coat, they kill a goat. They spread the blood around on it. And they take it back to their dad and they throw it at his feet and said, hey, we found this. We think it might belong to your son. Such cold and calculated moves. Just one more deception, one more act of hatred to add to the good family legacy, huh? And it's hard to believe as we read through stories like this that good can come out of these situations, doesn't it? I mean, you can only imagine what's going through Joseph's mind as all of this is happening. It's like, what did I do? I didn't do anything. Sometimes we feel like that in our lives when things start to go wrong, don't we? You know, if you were Joseph and you knew that your value was nothing but 20 pieces of silver, where would your self-esteem be? Would it be pretty high? Or would it be pretty low? A lot of us have been in that situation of low self-esteem because life can sure throw some nasty twists at us, can't it? Things that we don't see coming, because all of his life, Joseph had been the favorite son, all 17 years of it. The favorite son, the privileged son, the son who didn't have to take out the trash, the son who got to wear the nice robe, who didn't have to work, the son that his father loved. And we see these nasty twists and turns all the time in our lives, don't we? Especially in the recent days in the economy that we've had, people losing jobs, and lost jobs turn into lost houses, lost cars, lost possessions. And stuff like that starts to add up and it starts to hurt, doesn't it? Some deep, deep hurt that can leave us wondering, where is God in all of these situations? In Arizona, just last weekend, I couldn't believe when I started reading through the headlines and reading some of the stories of the shooting that occurred in Tucson last Saturday. It just blew my mind. Can you imagine what a life-changing, life-altering event that was for the people who were involved in all of that? The people who were the victims, the families of the victims. It broke my heart to read the story of the little 9-year-old girl. All of the story, all the hopes and dreams that she had of peace, of renewal, and all this stuff. And here she was killed in an act of terrorism. It's almost ironic, and it breaks my heart, but the reality of the situation is this, that our everyday lives are filled with surprises that have the potential to ruin our relationship with God. Life has that potential, doesn't it? And the things that it throws at us, those twists and those turns, can take us to places that we never, ever thought that we would be. The things happen that are out of our control, and we don't understand them. And sometimes even just in our everyday, quote-unquote, busy lives are things that have the potential to ruin our relationship with God. And I've been talking with the teenagers about this, but I don't understand that when all of this is going on, why God is the thing that we leave behind. When all of life is crashing down around us, our relationship with God, our relationship even with our church family, is the first thing that we willingly sacrifice, isn't it? It's, oh, I'm just too busy for that. Oh, God wasn't there for that, so I don't need God anymore. I don't understand why God is the first thing that we willingly sacrifice when life goes wrong. The one in whom our lives should emanate from, the one that we should build our lives on, is the very first thing to go. And it blows my mind. The lesson in this whole story of Joseph for you and I, and there's many of them in this story, but the lesson that I want us to understand tonight is this, that no action in our life is more powerful than prayer. The text really doesn't say, but I can't help but wonder what happened after the end of verse 33. Did it really go from, here's this coat, we found it, we think it might belong to Joseph, to this is all that happened to Judah in the very next chapter? I can't help but wonder if Jacob, realizing his failures as a father, broke down. If he went and poured out his heart to God in prayer, you know, what would this entire scene have looked like? I mean, as a father, what would that have felt like to have known that your favorite son, the son of your old age, the son of the one woman that you actually loved, was dead? What would that feel like? I mean, I'm not a dad. And I can't really say that I know what that would feel like, but I can't imagine the pain and the sorrow and the agony that would go into that moment as you stand there and realize that your son is dead. And their brother is so cold and calculated about it. I can't help but think that he had to go back into that room and just fall on his knees. And maybe he didn't even stay on his knees. Maybe he just fell on his face to say this prayer to God. I mean, how else could he have gone on? How else do you go on after something like that? Where else could you have turned for hope? The same thing in all this, I think, can be said for you and me. That prayer brings the power to endure. When everything goes wrong, when our lives are crashing down around us, the God that we so often leave behind is the God that we should be calling out for, be crying out to help us endure this hardship. We don't read much about Joseph and God up to this point in his story. And that's interesting to me. And I wonder how much God was a part of his life as he was growing up. If God was someone that they talked about frequently, if it was, you know, hey son, how was Bible class today? You know, what did you learn? If God was a big part of things in his life, or if there was really nothing, you know? Or was he really, really a deep thinker? Was he really a pretty special kid that was really in touch with God? I mean, I really don't know. But I can't help but wonder some of those questions. But I think it's safe to say that as Joseph is there with the Midianites on his way to Egypt, that he probably had to turn that situation over to God, didn't he? Surely even at 17, he knew that his only hope would come through God's intervention. You know, if he hadn't learned that lesson in the first 17 years of his life, he was definitely right in the middle of learning that lesson as we end that chapter, wasn't he? Right in the middle of, okay, God, you know, I need you a little bit more than I thought. You know, as we're taking a look in Joseph's life, can you see how God is working? In just these few verses, just out of one chapter, can you see how God is working? Even without the fact that we know the rest of the story, can you see how God is working? How God got him out of a terrible home life. It may have been a very shocking way to be ripped out of your father's household, but God got him out of that. God got him where he needed to be. God was about to take care of him in everything that he did. And it's hard for me to imagine good coming from that household and in that situation. Can you believe, knowing the rest of the story, of what God was able to do with such a mess? It's easy for us in our lives to play the victim. And if anyone could have done it throughout history, Joseph certainly could have played the victim more than anybody that I know. And so many of us do that, don't we? We say, well, God didn't do this for me. God, he wasn't there to help me. He wasn't there. God doesn't care about me. You can see just by all of this stuff that's been happening in my life, God doesn't care about me. And it's at that moment in our lives, I think, that we have to stop and ask ourselves, where is God? And this is something that I've been learning more and more in my life as well. That when things start to go wrong, rather than running away from God, we have to start looking for God in that situation and wondering where God is and what God is doing. We have to learn to look for him. When life gets crazy, we can't just leave God behind. If we're going to make it through our lives, God is the only one who can get us to the end. There is no action in our life more powerful than prayer. And I think that is exemplified in the lives of Jacob and of Joseph. We would love to pray for you tonight. If there are prayers that you need, we would love nothing more than to baptize you into a life with Christ. Sometimes it just takes that new beginning. If there's anything that we can do, anything that we can help you with tonight, we ask that you please come as we stand.